Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Welcome to CCNA Discovery 1, Chapter 3, Part 1. Not Part 2, there'll be a Part 2 next week. Part 1 with Elise Lonsdale on behalf of the Cisco Academy for the Vision Impaired. How's everybody going this morning?
Pretty good.
Pretty good.
Excellent. So we've got three of you here today, Kim, Narissa and Scott. It's great to have you all along. I know there's a few people in the class who aren't with us today, so let's hope they can enjoy the lecture in listener land. There's quite a bit to get on with, so I'll make this brief. Are there any questions from the last two chapters? And Pat's just coming in now, so let's hope she comes down. Okay, I'll take that as a no.
Sorry, Scott, I accidentally called you Marshall before. I realised that...
I moved you, Pat.
It's got your name the other way around. Sorry, Scott.
No, it's Marshall Scott.
I've been having that trouble ever since I was born, so don't worry about it.
They do things back to front in America.
Got Scott as a middle name, and it's a name I think's very nice.
And good morning or good afternoon to Pat, who's joined us. I've moved you down into the channel because we really need to get moving. Have you got any questions from the previous chapters, Pat?
No, I'm fine on them. Doing very well, thank you.
Has anyone read their chapter notes? I know you have, Narissa.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. Now, the reason I say that is because it's a difficult chapter. And I'm going to start this chapter off, being chapter 3, with is that the first thing I'm going to say to you as your instructor is you have the permission to stuff up. Yep, get it wrong if you want. Make heaps of mistakes because those mistakes will provoke you to ask questions, and the more discussion that goes on, the better with this chapter. As far as, it's one of those double-edged swords. If we have too much discussion, we'll never get through it. But we do need to talk about a few things. It's quite involved, and there are a lot of new concepts. And this is why I say it's okay to get it wrong. The exam will ask you questions. You'll go, oh my God, I didn't even know that existed. And you'll have to be aware of a few things like ARP. What's another thing I saw earlier on? Different types of MAC addresses. You'll need to make yourself aware of IP addressing. Know the differences between MAC addresses and IP addressing, or physical addressing and logical addressing, respectively. There's going to be a lot to learn. And I know people often go ahead and think, oh, well, the last two chapters are easy. Chapter 3, I'll get through this one as well and crater in the exam. My advice to you is that I will put the exam up at the end of this lecture, but don't take it unless you're really, really confident, or I will certainly say to you, even wait until the end of next week. Narissa, I know you've been studying this, so I'm just going to ask, do you have any questions at this point that you think occurred in your mind or that you think other students might be thinking about asking?
One thing that's confused me a bit, where it talks about the Ethernet, is that like a system of connection that is actually used on the internet?
The Ethernet standard is a set of rules and protocols that basically govern how machines will talk. TCP/IP. It's the standard, and we'll talk about these standards because in days gone by there were things like Banyan Vines, Novell NetWare, Apple Talk. I think IBM had a standard, and because they had different standards, you're locked into a vendor's specific way of communicating. So, you know, Novell NetWare didn't talk to people who were on Apple Talk, or Apple Talk didn't talk to people who were on Banyan Vines, etc., unless you had some sort of way of interconnecting, all that sort of stuff. So Ethernet was a standard, and we'll talk about why Ethernet got so popular, and I think we do that in the first half of Chapter 3, so you'll get an answer to that question. Because it promotes connectivity, and if connectivity promotes competition, and if everyone's got a standard, it means that you can buy equipment from one vendor, and because it conforms to the rules, which we'll also discuss as we move through, you can hook up an IBM piece of equipment with a Toshiba piece of equipment. You can hook up a Cisco piece of equipment to some other vendor's equipment, and they all talk the same language.
So I understood that, but what confused me was it's been talked about all the time with small business networking, office networking, that sort of thing, but I thought, well, it's got to be used worldwide because they talk about packages and UDPs and all that with the internet as well, so it's got to be used.
Yep, so it's got to be used everywhere, hasn't it? Ethernet is the standard. It's the standard that everybody uses. Ethernet is the standard that everyone uses, be it big business, little business, micro business. We all have Ethernet now.
Yeah, which is what I thought, but I just wanted to get that totally clear in my mind.
Yeah, no, it's a good valid point. It's a good valid point.
When I was reading into the chapter, it kept saying that a printer could be known as a host too because it had an IP address. And I'm still a little confused about how a printer can be addressed as a host. Can you explain that?
Yep, certainly can. We were looking at, Kim and I were looking at a Browning Bosser this morning that also has Ethernet. So the Ethernet's getting around everywhere. But any device on the network that has an IP address is referred to as a host. Okay, so it has an IP address, we can contact it, and we'll discuss that in the first part of next week's chapter, why the IP addressing is so important, and we'll really do this in chapter 5, so stand by for more on your IP addressing, Pat. But basically, it talked in this chapter about shared resources and hosts, and you can have a printer with an IP address and an Ethernet connection that is a host, just like your computer is a host on the network. Also, if you have a printer that is connected via a computer, which most of us still do, connected usually by a USB cable these days, or is connected by, in the older days, a parallel cable, that doesn't have an IP address and therefore is not referred to as a host. It in this instance is referred to as a shared resource. So we can use the shared resource to print, and we can share it out to other computers on our network. But it is a shared resource, not a host, or it doesn't have an IP address. Is that making sense?
Yes. Is it that only a host has an IP address? I thought it had to have IP address and talk or send out and receive information.
It has to have an IP address, and that's basically what we say. But for an IP to exist for anything to exist on the network properly, it also has to have a subnet mask, which we'll discuss in Chapter 5. And if it's a machine that has to communicate outside the network, it also has to have a default gateway. You'll probably find your printer doesn't have to connect outside the network, so it might only ask you for a default for a subnet mask and an IP address. Are we ready to go? All right, with networks. Okay, there's many different types of networks available to people. Over the course of a day, a person might make a phone call, watch a television show, listen to the radio, look at something on the internet, play a video game even with somebody in another country. Now, all of these activities rely on robust and reliable networks and network communications. Generally, people use networks these days without even thinking about how it all works, especially people who are new to computing. They just know that they can get on the internet, do some online shopping, and away they go. They don't need to think about the way it all works. You can watch a television show in Australia that might be coming out of Sydney, for example, where most of us are in Melbourne. You can be in America and watch the morning shows out of New York or something. So, you don't even think about it. It's just everyday occurrence these days. Now, let's throw it open to the group for some discussion here. What are some various types of networks that you might think about?
Telephone.
Yep, telephone's one. Any others?
Cable network. TV.
Yep, I like cable TV.
Radio.
Radio is a network, yep. And radio stations obviously network. Any others?
The network for mobile phones.
Yep, and cellular network, that's a good one. Any others? What's a group of people sitting around a table?
A gossip session.
I was about to say, other than a gossip session, hey?
I almost said gossip session as well, but Nerissa beat me to it.
People might say it's a human network. In human networks, we have business networks and all sorts of things. So just networks of people, networks of anything communicating is a network. Okay, new technologies these days create a newer and better types of networks. Okay, these days, we're going into convergence. We used to have networks that was just sort of single networks. Like, for example, we had our computer network. And back in the 1980s, for example, our desk might have looked like we had a telephone, a fax machine, a computer, and they never talked. You couldn't talk. We might have had our TV in the corner. They were all networked. For example, you might have had your TV on the cable TV system, and you might have had your computer with a dial-up modem, or even connected via a network to the office network, etc. You had your telephone and your fax machine, etc. And then you might walk in with your cellular phone that looked like a Motorola brick or something, all on different networks. But in the recent years, of course, we've had the convergence of networks. We now have computer networks talking to the plain old telephone system, or POTS, or the PSTN, Public Switch Telephone Network, depending on which one you like the sound of better. We now can watch TV and radio, stream radio and television broadcasts on our computers. We even have And there's been some discussion in the ITE group about, you know, TV cards and capture cards and stuff, so we can actually simply plug our computers into a television antenna or a cable TV outlet. And, you know, with the, you know, bit of know-how and software, have our TV on our computers. These newer converged networks obviously are quite capable of carrying voice, video and data all over the same network. I woke up this morning, called Kim on the phone over the same network that I'm using to talk to you on. You know, I've got a VoIP connection, I ring Canada just as if it's the next door neighbour now, and don't even think about it. So, you know, it's just, as long as the router's up and as long as my internet connection's stable, I'm using that same network from this point anyway, to go out and use and make a VoIP call to Ontario. And it basically just says here in the notes what I've said. Okay, the benefits of networking. Okay, the networks that we use these days come in all sizes. There's small networks like what's in your home office, often referred to as a SOHO network, SOHO, which stands for the Small Office Home Office. They can even go across to different campuses of the school or different campuses of the university. Now, with our SOHO network, and of course there's that big, bad, nasty network that everyone's connected to. What's it called, gang?
Internet.
The internet.
That's it. G'day, Paul. Yep, and g'day, Narissa. Thanks for that. Now, it's a big internet, isn't it? Okay, with all our networks, we can... we're back to our SOHO group of networks. They're traditionally used for sharing out printers, documents, pictures, and music across a few local computers in a small business or something. In business, large networks can be used to advertise and sell products, order supplies, and communicate with customers. Now, I know with Lotus Notes, for example, I know car manufacturers were using that, and they had databases in Japan, but they were being accessed by terminals here in, like, Melbourne. And they could also be accessing a local database with their Lotus Notes, for example, and the user may not even know at the desktop. They just click on the database and open it up, and they get their information in and out of it. And they may not know whether it's a local one or a one from even another country. Obviously, networks allow for rapid communication, such as instant message and email. They allow for consolidation of information storage and access to information on other services, which I've just basically said. Businesses and with SOHO networks usually provide a shared connection to the internet for all of their people in the office. And the internet is considered a network of networks because it is literally made up of thousands of networks that are connected to each other, and this is important. The internet is a network of networks. Okay, what other things can you use the internet for, gang?
Voice over internet protocol, which is VoIP.
Yep, can you just back off from the microphone a bit, Paul? It sounds like you're eating it. Yep, voice over IP, anything else?
Long-distance learning.
Yeah, that's a good one, Pat. Long-distance learning. Anything else? Kim, what do you and I do on it just about every day, well, every day of the week?
Ah, well, we communicate via Skype. I was also going to say people can shop online, but I wasn't sure if that had already been said.
Yeah, they're both valid points. We're always on Skype. I was also thinking of the VoIP. Actually, Paul said that. So we're always on Skype. And we're texting, and we're doing heaps of things. And I could stream audio from here if I could be bothered setting it all up. But people do set up audio to be streamed. We're listening to the radio. Well, the other day when I was listening to the cyclone where my auntie was, I was streaming Darwin Radio all day. Of course, Nerissa will know about that. Check in with Yvonne. I don't suppose you checked in with Yvonne yesterday, did you? She all right?
Yes, everything's fine, yes.
Yeah, I spoke to her Wednesday night last time. I think we rung. I meant to ring her yesterday. So yeah, it means that we can stay in contact with friends and loved ones even in the time of crisis and emergency. This was Category 1 cyclone up the top end where my auntie lives. So you know, it means we don't have to. File sharing programs, yes. Don't you just love them?
Certainly do.
Okay. Yeah. Well, this is just it. I mean, it's file sharing's good. Okay. There's a section here in the notes about basic network components, and they can be categorized as follows. Hosts, which I spoke of when I was talking to Pat earlier. Shared peripherals, which is another thing that Pat was asking about, the shared peripheral being a shared printer. Networking devices, which we'll come to a bit later. and networking media, and the media being the lump of cable between your computer and the next thing that it's connected to, usually Ethernet cable these days. It says here the types of device, hang on, the network components that people are most familiar with these days are hosts and shared peripherals, which is exactly what Pat was speaking about earlier. Now, hosts, we said before, are devices that have an IP address, but hosts are devices that share, that basically send and receive messages across the network. And a host is a generic name for most end-user devices. And a host has an IP address. And an example of a host are personal computers and network-attached printers. Now, it says here shared peripherals are not directly connected to the network, but are instead connected to hosts. And that's exactly what I said to you, Pat. So did any of that make sense earlier on?
Yeah.
Lovely. Okay, and in this instance, the host is then responsible for sharing the peripheral. Okay, hosts have special computer software enabled that allows the network to allow to use the shared devices. So in other words, Windows might share out a printer. There's part of Windows that comes built in that allows for sharing of these resources. You can also share out a drive across a network too. Now, examples of... What's that? You've been doing that, have you, Narissa?
Yes, I've been doing that drive mapping.
Ah, and how did you find it? Yeah, I think there's a thing in one of the worksheets, share out a drive.
Yes, I've now got one between me and my husband's computer and one between my computer and my laptop.
So, did you share out a drive or did you share out a directory or a folder?
Well, I gave them letters, so...
yeah, but you can give the resource on the destination computer a letter.
But you put them, they had subfolders in them.
Yep, but when the original share, the thing you actually shared out, was that the actual root directory of a drive or was that a folder that you found on the computer somewhere?
I followed the instructions in the lab. I made a new folder, like I did that procedure where you click on tools and then you click on assigning a letter. And then you put a folder in the box below. You know, I followed the instructions of the lab.
Okay, yep. So you haven't really answered the question. Doesn't matter, no matter anyway, because you had to share it. I'm talking about the resource. I'm not talking about the drive letter you assigned that resource on the receiving end. I'm talking about what you actually shared out. And you can share out either the entire C drive or the D drive, or you can share out a particular folder on that drive.
No, it was a specific folder, not an entire drive.
No, that's fair enough. And it does warn against sharing out your C drive, because if any computer came onto your network, a guest computer that had a worm, it would be easy to worm its way across onto the C drive and get into your Windows directory and so on and so forth. So they usually recommend that you share out a particular folder. I actually shared out a whole drive on my computer here because it is a separate drive. It's just a 500 gig scratch drive I got here with nothing but junk on it, to be blunt. And that's how my Samba server works on the Linux machine. It tricks Windows into thinking that it's a Windows machine, and it offers Windows particular shares that are really just folders and directories on the Linux machine. So Windows just sees it as another Windows machine. So that's good. So we can share, and that's how we get access to our documents in the network. Is that somebody might share out a folder or a set of folders on a computer. And that's how everybody else can, you know, access the documents that are there for the use of the office.
The way I understood the worksheet was that you shared out a folder with subfolders in it if you wanted to, and then you assigned that a specific number.
Yeah, usually you share out the folder, and as you say, it can have subs folders, and in your case it probably would have, because as you said, you need it for you and your husband. And on the destination machine, you assign that a drive letter, so you can do your drive mapping. You don't necessarily have to, but you can. You can use My Network Places and just go to the resource there, which is what I do on my EEE, because my EEE may not always be connected to my network, and I didn't want to see messages unable to reconnect to drive P, unable to reconnect to drive L, or whatever, Whereas on my main machine, because it never leaves the network, I have got drive mapping done, and drive L is actually Lonestar Media on the server. So yes, that's you've done it right by the sounds of it. You've done it to the letter, and it's all working well, and that's good. So not only have you done something from the worksheet, you found a practical application for it right away as soon as you did it for you and Ian.
Oh, that's right. It's going to be I've used my network places in the past, but this is going to be easy. We can just click on drive in and away we go.
Yep, that's right. Yes, Paul.
I have a question regarding I'm going to be purchasing a new PC within a couple of days, and I was wondering if I could use my wireless internet without a wireless card on a desktop. Because I want to be able to network the two computers.
Okay, well, this is a bit off topic, but I fail to see how you're going to use a wireless network without a wireless card.
Okay. Because what I was going to do is connect it using I was going to connect it.
Okay, if you've got wireless internet coming to some router, to where? To a router?
Yes, a router. It's got three Ethernet ports on it.
Well, okay, well, that will probably work, because you can connect some routers to wireless internet and then have the router reroute that out through the local network, and you can connect your computer to it and get some IP. Yep, that should work. A little bit off topic, though, but yes, it will work.
Alright, thank you.
Okay, because we need to come back here to peripherals for a tick. Okay, that's okay, no worries, Paul. Now, okay, it's talking about shared peripherals, or peripherals anyway, which really fall into digital cameras, scanners, and locally attached printers. That's what we've already sort of gone into. Network devices, next subject. Okay, networking devices connect other devices, mainly hosts, to the network. These devices move and control traffic around the network. Now, this is important. There are three types mentioned here, and they are as follows. Hubs, switches, and routers. And most of the course from this point forward will discuss the differences between a hub, a switch, and a router. And these devices, these boxes, let's say, are known as devices as opposed to hubs. As opposed to hosts, okay? Hosts being our computer, or our VoIP box or something, or our media player, a device being a hub, switch, or router. Any questions? Okay, there's another aspect of all this you need to be concerned about, and we'll discuss this in great detail next week in Chapter 4, is the network media. Network media provides connections between hosts and network devices. Network media can be wired, such as Ethernet cable, or wireless technologies. And Ethernet cable, also with the physical connections, we also include fibre optics in that too, so we'll just be discussing all of that. Now, some devices can play more than one role depending on how they are connected. For example, a printer connected to a host, a local printer, is a peripheral, and then we know that a printer, can be connected to a network device and participate directly in network communications as a host. So it basically reiterates what I said. You can connect your network printer to your device, like your switch or your router, and it will play a positive part in your network. Section 3.1.4. Are there any questions before I go on to the next bit, which is computer roles in networks is the next bit. Any questions so far? Okay, then we know that our computer hosts connect to the network, and in modern networks they can act as either a client or a server. Now, this is also another pertinent point, and there is a lab that I think Narissa may have been discussing on the weekend with me on how to set up a peer-to-peer network. Now, the software installed on the computer determines which role the computer will play. Now, there are servers that are known. There are servers, which are really hosts, that enable the distribution of email, web pages, etc. Now, I'm going to make an example here. My Endeavour server, formerly Challenger, if you're listening from 6 months ago, and I do promote people get this same chapter out from August last year, where I refer to Challenger and stuff. There's software running on that enables email to be sent to email clients. Currently, I have two email clients connected to it, and that's been Outlook Express on my EEE PC, and either Outlook or Thunderbird on this machine, depending on what I'm running at the time. They both connect to the same host or the same server to fetch the email that comes in here. You can also have your server serving up web pages and serving up things like streaming, multimedia, etc. Now, each of these services, let's call them services on the server, require specialized software. For example, there's a program here running called Dovecot that allows the ability for email clients to use POP3 or IMAP to receive the email. If anyone looks at ciscovision.org, that comes also off my server, and that requires a program called Apache, which is really the world's most popular web server software. And now Ventrilo is a good example. Ventrilo is a client that connects to v47.darkstarllc.com. Now it connects to the server, which I believe is in Perth, and it too has to run the appropriate software to allow the Ventrilo clients to connect, authenticate, and run. Now, what's some examples of client software, for example, guys?
A mail reader.
Web browsers.
Yep, like those.
Something like Instant Messenger.
Yep, I am. Anything else?
The music streaming software like RealPlayer or, maybe WAMP. I don't use that particular program.
Absolutely, exactly. And I was thinking Miranda, which is one that Kim uses for IM. But yep, I like the Real Audio type scenario. That's good. It's a client. Paul said web browsers. So basically an email client. So they're the clients. Now, a computer, back to the server, a computer running server software can provide these services simultaneously. So at any one time, any server running, such as in my home business here, and you can get Microsoft Small Business Server too. I'm running a Linux server here. Can be serving up a web page to any one of the websites I've got running off it, as well as delivering the email, or people like Jackie and Kim who can connect into that server and get email too if they so wish. So, and they also connect in to put files on and off it by using a program called WinSCP, which is a client, and it runs across the SSH protocol. I could also have an FTP is another client. We should have thought about gang. FTP, you can have an FTP client. A lot of web hosts, for example, run FTP to allow people to put up and pull down their websites. I don't run it here, but as I said, we use WinSCP across the SSH protocol because it's a little bit more secure. But yeah, an FTP client would have been a good example back then too. So my server can be serving out stuff on SSH to people who are connecting, and it can be doing the email for myself and serving out web pages to anyone who cares to look. Also, the clients' computers can also be running multiple programs. I have an email program open now. I've got the Word program open to look at these notes. I've got Ventrilo open, and there's probably still one or two browser sessions out there from when I was doing my banking earlier, which are signed out but probably left hanging. So the computers are all multitasking. Now, there really must be client software for every service required. We have to have our email program, we have to have our web browser, and so on. Okay, any questions? Okay, 1.3.5 continues with peer-to-peer networking. Now, peer-to-peer networking is a quick and simple way to set up a functional network. Okay, as we've just discussed, client and server software runs on separate computers. That's a client-server arrangement. But in a peer-to-peer network, you can actually have it where one computer can carry out both roles at the same time. How about that? Yep, so you can be, the boss might have his computer in the office and everyone connects to that computer to get some files off it, but at the same time the boss can be sitting at his desk with the screen turned so that his employees don't see him playing solitaire or free cell. But if he's actually doing his work and looking at his email or writing documents or firing people, his server is actually working as a workstation as well as a server. So he can have documents and things being served out from there, and also using the workstation as using the computer as a normal workstation. Now, this is going to be a good example. Narissa is going to be a good case in point here. You've got both your you got some drives shared out because you did that lab last week and you found a practical application for it already. What type of network do you think you have, Nerissa, a client server or peer-to-peer?
It would have to be a client server because peer-to-peer is just... With one specific cable going from my computer to my husband's, we would have to be going through the router, so that would mean we'd have to be using the internet server, because if the internet was turned off, and I don't have a twisted pair of Ethernet cable going between mine and my husband's computer, like hypothetically if the internet was down, because I had to use my IP address.
Let's not muddy the waters. Okay, if the internet went down, your client, your little peer-to-peer network, which is actually what it is, would still work. Because you have, on the other side of that router, you actually have the surfboard modem to Optus, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so let's say I came into your house and blew up your surfboard modem. You would find that your little peer-to-peer network to you and Ian's computer would actually still function. And here's why.
I had to connect using IP addresses. You know, you had to type in the IP address. I thought that...
You're not going outside your network. All those IP addresses that you probably typed in, if you did any of that last week, will be all local stuff. Yep, the internet can go and blow itself up.
I see what you mean, they're internal.
Yep, they're internal IP addresses. Remember when I was going through that heartache of 5 days of no internet back in 2009, when I was changing from Hotkey to TPG, and I was going over from the ADSL1 infrastructure to the ADSL2 infrastructure, which is why I had the outage. My internal network worked perfectly. I was still working off Challenger back then, and I wasn't getting an email in through here, of course, because there was no internet, so I had to reroute that somewhere else. But all the network communications, wireless, everything was working as it would. Internal, of course.
I was forgetting it was internal IP addresses I was typing.
Yep, and this is good that we're having this discussion.
Yes. I actually have a problem. I'm on medication and I can never think very well early in the morning. If you'd asked me the same thing at 10 o'clock at night, I would have given you a better answer.
We'll try that next time after a few card games.
Okay.
After we've sworn at each other for the last hour and a half, if you're still in the mood to talk to me, that is. It's amazing what goes around. Yes, hon?
I was going to say that, you know, when you go look at your... if you go in the system tray and you look to see what you're connected to, it always says local and internet. Well, mine usually does, unless I'm only connected locally, so... And I don't do anything locally, but you could. And I probably will when I get the...
You could. Computer. Yeah, when you get that new machine, you'll be able to have that set up as a peer-to-peer network on there, and you'll be able to... and you will, too, because... Well, make sure you will. So you're going to want to be able to get, you know, stuff between them very, very quickly. So and then they'll both have access to the internet anyway. So we'll just share. You can just share out a folder and do what Nerissa's done basically. You can connect them directly, but the mere fact they're connected by a switch, which is really what they are, or an integrated services router, etc., still means that they're peer to peer because they can run both server and client software. Now it's acting as a server when, let's say Nerissa or Kim, when she gets her new computer, shares out a folder on a drive somewhere, and it's available to, okay, we're still on? Yep. Okay, so we've got Nerissa and Kim sitting there, they've shared out a folder. In that instance, the machine is actually acting as a server, and the other computer is actually acting as a client. But in actual fact, they're a peer-to-peer network, because the resources are shared equally. You can have documents on one computer. You're not running an email server, or you're not serving out web pages, etc., and we'll talk about the advantages and disadvantages. So they both have, there's minimal or no security, and they both have much the same sorts of responsibilities on the network, and we'll discuss in better detail the peer-to-peer and client-server differences in a minute. And there are some questions in the test about the advantages and disadvantages thereof. I wish that crow would shut up outside. The simplest peer-to-peer network consists of two directly connected computers, which is what there's a lab there that does that. Most people these days are still able to set up peer-to-peer networks through their local network. And in essence, because I said I've got that, even though I've got a client-server arrangement here, I do have some peer-to-peer activity. because there's that big, huge scratch drive I've got shared out, so I can easily dump things on there if I want to get them across to the Triple E. If I didn't have that, I don't really believe in sharing out bits of what's on your Windows partition, because it's a bit nasty. So I would often put stuff up on the server and get it down off the other computer, and then I'd be acting as a client-server situation. And here it goes, there's a passage here that says multiple PCs can be connected to create a larger peer-to-peer network. So if, for example, Nerissa's son or daughter came over, plugged in their computer to the network, they might have three peer-to-peer, three computers on their peer-to-peer network. Now this requires a network.
When I plug the laptop in,
yeah.
That's basically what I'm doing, isn't it?
Yep, you've extended your peer-to-peer network by one, and you now have three computers on it. Okay, typically this is done by means of a hub or a switch. It starts you off here as a hub, and we'll discuss the differences between hub switches and routers as the course goes on. We're going to mic up. Now, it says here in businesses, due to the high amounts of traffic, it's important to have dedicated servers, and that's where we move into the small office, home office environment. Might have small business server, like myself, a Linux server sitting in the corner. The classroom might have a server for its students, and then we go up to the next level again, where a company might have one or two different services, or even more, to handle a high volume of traffic. Now, some of the advantages of the peer-to-peer network are: they're easy to set up, less complexity, lower costs, as dedicated network devices and servers are not required, and can be used for simple tasks such as sharing files and network printers, or shared peripherals, really. Now, there are some disadvantages to all of this. There's no centralized administration. There's not as much security. It's not scalable, so once we get past a certain point, we run into having too much network traffic or with licensing issues with Windows. We can't have too many clients. And all devices may act as clients and servers, which actually slow their performance. So that's some of the disadvantages. And some of these questions crop up in the test, if I remember rightly, too, so be aware of them. Okay, a little info on client-server networks. Microsoft operating systems have built-in server software that allows any computer to share stored files across the network, as Nerissa's found out. When you share a file, the computer is acting as a server, which is what I've just said to Nerissa. Also, Microsoft Windows has built-in software that allows any computer to act as a client to access shared files on another computer. In this instance, the machine is acting as a client. Okay, are there any questions before we move on to the principles of communications? All right, the primary purpose of any, in principles of communications, the primary purpose of any network is to provide information. To the very earliest of humans, to the advanced scientists today, the concept of sharing information is crucial. Now, I don't know whether I should harp on about everybody else does it, the Tower of Babel, how God came along and just basically broke the method of communications by changing everybody's language. That caused a heck of a problem, and probably still does, to be honest. So we have all these different languages and different standards, and we'll come back to that. So with all communications, all communications begins with information. This paragraph is not really worded basically, but all basic methods of communications, whether it be from early man to people who are building towers to people who are communicating across networks, really needs basically three entities, and that is the source, the destination, and the channel. Okay, there's these three elements: source, destination, and channel. And the message source is the sender. Now, in this instance, I'm the message source. I'm broadcasting to you, and we'll talk about broadcasting later. I'm the message source. You people are the receiver, and the Ventrilo and the internet and all the subsequent technology in between, you and I are the channel. So you, the destination, and listening to my message. Hopefully you're understanding it. And the channel is often referred to as the pathway, okay? The pathway over which the message is sent. There is a diagram in the notes at this point, and I'm not sure how well it's described, but basically it depicts the method of communications between two humans, basically, and they're probably on a telephone or something like that. Okay, when a signal is transmitted over the transmission media and received, it's reassembled into a coherent message. Now, with all this communication, this is all very good, we can communicate, but there are some rules. We can't just keep blabbing away there and just wondering whether it's been received and understood. We actually do have rules in communications. Okay. In any conversation between two people, and let's just look at some people standing in the room, there are still rules and protocols, and if they're not followed, communications will break down. Okay, among the protocols for successful communications are identification of sender and receiver. Hi, Kim, how are you? It's Elise. So we communicate with each other. Okay, agreed upon medium. That can be either face-to-face, telephone, or VoIP, or letter, whatever you want to use. And we have the appropriate communications mode, which can either be spoken, written, or illustrated or interactive, or even one-way communication. We need to also have a common language, so if I walked in here and started speaking Spanish, you wouldn't understand me. Well, maybe some people in America might, but generally speaking, we need to be speaking the same language. Grammar and sentence structure, and speed and timing of delivery. We teach all this in Toastmasters, actually pause for effect. Imagine what would happen if no protocols and rules existed. Would we be able to understand people? Probably not. Now, for you people in the chat, if we had no rules and proper communications, would you understand this? Now, depending on what speech synthesizer you've got running off your Ventrilo, some of you will understand that easier than others. I tested this with Kim earlier today. She went back and read it twice. And then she got the gist of it the first time, but understood more of it. It's hard. There's no rules there. There's just a heap of words. What's that?
It sounded like, not in the voice itself, but it sounded like the little chipmunky voices from the cartoons. I was using AT&T Crystal, and she was very non-understandable.
Exactly, and unfortunately we can't portray this out for the people who are listening in listener land, but I'll just send the real version now. Now, I bet you that was easier. And it basically said it is very difficult to understand messages that do not follow the standard rules and protocols, or words to that effect anyway. And in it's written in the notes, so if you read through your chapter notes, you'll hear it with whichever speech synthesizer you're running. But the second time I sent that message was much easier to follow. Why? Because I think there should have at least been one comma in it. There were certainly spaces. And, the more complex sentence would have the necessary punctuation. So, Kim and I were looking at the website recently, and one of the things what we were amazed at is that the words were running, the sentences were just running together. And it was hard to hear. It was hard to listen to. It was really, really hard to get the message that the person wanted to convey on their website. So, they're not following an agreed, established rule, set of rules and parameters. They're making their message hard to get. Okay, so these protocols have to be specific to the source, destination, and channel of the message. So this gets back to the Ethernet question that was posed earlier. We're all using Ethernet now because everyone understands it. Okay, the rules that we use to communicate over the telephone system may not be necessarily the same rules that we would use to communicate by letter, for example. We have our message format, and some of the protocols and rules that we look at are something like the message format itself, the message size, the timing of bits of the message, the encapsulation of bits of parts of the message, the encoding of parts of the message, and the pattern standard message pattern. Okay, many of these rules that we use in human communications apply to computer communications, believe it or not. One of the first steps to sending a message is encoding it. written words, pictures, etc., need to be encoded, and encoded into a way that the computer will understand, basically. Encoding is the process of converting thoughts into language, and that's what we're doing all the time. I'm encoding my thoughts into language that's understood by you people, and you people are decoding that language and hopefully getting some reasonable message out of it. And as it says here, decoding reverses that process to interpret the thought, and that's what it says. Imagine a person watching a sunset and calling somebody on the telephone to describe how beautiful that sunset looks. The first thing that has to happen is the sender has to first encode their thoughts and perceptions about the sunset into words. Okay, the words are then spoken into the telephone using, you know, inflection and using language and inflection, etc., that convey the message. On the other end, so that can be the channel, the telephone can be the channel. On the other end of the telephone line, the person listening to the description can decode the sounds in order to visualize the sunset being described. So there you go. Encoding also occurs in computer communications. Okay, now some of this encoding has to be in an appropriate form for the medium used. Okay, let's have a look at this in greater detail. A message sent across the network has to be first converted into bits by the host. Bits. This is going to get important. Each bit is encoded into light or wavelengths of sound or electrical impulses, depending on the type of network media used. Okay, so let's think about the bits that are encoded into electrical impulses, which is the bits that are going through our cable from our computer, because most of us here are connected, I think, probably by means of cable to a router or something, or some of you might be using Wi-Fi. Okay, that's what's happening here. My voice is encoded into bits and transmitted along the wire, which goes through my router and then is routed to another IP address that goes out onto my modem that goes out onto the internet. At that point, it's still bits on a copper wire and probably gets converted to God only knows what before it reaches the Ventrilo server, and then it goes out from the Ventrilo server out to you folks and probably ends up on another bit of wire into your computer and is decoded and heard as my voice. Magic, isn't it?
Well, that would be kind of like going from, like, you in Australia and then coming all the way to Hammond, Louisiana, for your voice is coming that far.
Yep, and it all happens within a second. It's incredible, isn't it, what goes on.
We'd have thought that was science fiction 30 years ago.
Oh, no. Well, even 30 years ago, we still had the plain old telephone, but, we had television and radio networking. But, yeah, to be able to sit here in our homes and with a program that Kim and I use called Fidelifone, we're now pretty much looking at almost 20K responses between our houses. It's pretty damn good. It's not bad. There's a diagram here depicting two people conversing, and then the programs that the conversation's broken down into these basic steps. One, a girl begins a conversation. She is the message source. The girl begins processing the thought and encodes it into English, assuming that's what she speaks. And then the girl begins to speak in English to the boy. And then the rest is 9 months later, guess what you get? In this instance, she defines herself as the transmitter. The audible signal generated by the conversation this audible signal generated by her is received as a conversation by the boy. The transmission link between the boy and the girl is defined as the channel, and that can just be simply sound waves if they're standing in the same room with each other. Okay, the receiver receives communications from the girl and decodes the signal so he can understand the content. And the receiver is known as the destination where the decoding occurs. Okay, back in computing communications, we have PC1 sends a message as a source. It is the message source. It sends a message and is referred to as a message source. Okay, PC1 again encodes the message and transmits it to PC2. The digital signal generated by PC1 is received PC2. So it's a data stream that is received by PC2. The transmission link between PC1 and PC2 is the channel. The receiver, PC2, receives the transmission and begins decoding it so it can understand the content. The receiver is known as the destination where decoding occurs. Any questions at this point?
Nope.
Okay, great. 3.4, 3.2 formatting. Okay, when a message is sent from source to destination, it must use a specific format or structure. Letter writing is one of the most common forms, well, was one of the most common forms of communications. And for centuries, the agreed format for letters really hasn't changed. In many cultures, it contains the following the following elements, and this is a format to most letters. A identifier of the recipient, a salutational greeting, the message content itself, a closing phrase, and an identifier of the sender. In addition, personal letters have to be enclosed or encapsulated into an envelope for delivery. Now, this encapsulation thing is important because this is what we're going to do, and we'll discuss it in greater detail as the course goes on. We're encapsulating our data so that it can be sent as bits along the wire. Okay, now, the envelope has an address of the receiver and usually the sender, but has to have the receiver, of course. So if I were to send a letter to Nerissa, it would have her address on it so that Australia Post would know how to deliver it. Also, if I was to send a letter to Kim, it would have to have her details on there and also with her country of Canada, so that Australia Post and Canada Post have to know where to send it. Our Australia Post system hands it into the international part of itself that sends it to North America, and the Canadian authorities pick it up and send it on to Hamilton. Now, the addresses are obviously relocated at the proper place on the envelope. So on the front of the envelope, we usually put the sender, the recipient's address. And either at the top left-hand corner or more often on the back of the envelope, we put our own address. So if it goes astray, we know where the package can be returned to. If the destination formatting of the address is not correct, the letter may not be delivered. Now, the process of placing the envelope in the letter inside an envelope is known as encapsulation, as I've just said. The de-encapsulation occurs is when the letter is received by the recipient and the letter is removed. So the de-encapsulation process is basically when you break open the envelope and pull out the letter. The message formatting. Well, I won't bore you with a diagram. That basically shows you how, you know, the message is sent by post. Yeah, okay, I'll let you read your notes for that because we've got to be conscious of time. Okay, a letter writer uses an accepted format to ensure that the letter is understood by the recipient. In the same way, a letter that is sent over or a message that is sent over the computer network follows the same rules. Now, I've already said, just as a letter is encapsulated into an envelope, a message is encapsulated into packets and frames, and then bits to be sent out across our computer network. Okay, this specific format is referred to as a frame. Now, basically, the frame, and this is important, the frame acts as an envelope and contains specific information about the address. And it also contains the address of the source host. And this is that we don't do this so early in this course, but we use another layered model called the OSI reference model, and that's layer 2 framing. And Marshall might be aware of doing some of that with Kerry in exploration. We discuss it more in Chapter 6, unfortunately. I'd like to have brought it in now. But basically, framing will have the MAC address or the physical address of the destination host and the sending host and the destination, basically. So like our envelope, we know where it's coming from and we know where it's going to. Now, messages that are not correctly formatted may not be delivered successfully to their host. Now, this is important. There's a little bit of a test thing here. So I'm going to suggest you read your notes and understand this. The components of a frame. Frame addressing. It has a physical hardware address, which is the MAC address, and we'll discuss it in greater detail later. And the source, the physical hardware address, which is the physical MAC address of what sent it. And the end of frame, and which is really the message, the end of message indicators. It's the end of frame and end of message indicators, so that the receiving host knows when the message is finished. Okay, it has an encapsulated message. Now this gets a little bit tricky here, so I'm going to say read your notes. There's a start flag of message. There's a recipient or destination identifier, as it's often referred to. There's a sender or source identifier, as it's often referred to. And the encapsulated data, in brackets, bits. Encapsulated, so bits inside this framed message. Okay, there's a diagram here. I'm not going to go through that, or am I? Let's see. It tries to identify a diagram where you've got to match how this goes together, and I'm sort of a bit conscious of time, but I certainly would suggest you read this part of the notes. It starts to get a little bit important here. Framing, just for people who have done the other course, and people, this course is structured a little bit differently, we would at this point start talking about switches, not routers, but switches. Okay, so for those people out there who are trying to grapple with the OC reference model, which we'll come back to, we'd be troubleshooting at layer 2 at that model. Okay, what have we got here? All of this sort of information relates to things like, you know, hello, goodbye, your message content and all that sort of stuff if you were two humans talking. Okay. Any questions at this point before we move on to message size?
Nope.
All right, we're just over the halfway mark. I'm sorry that I'm putting you to sleep. I know that not everyone out there is coming back to us. So, sometimes you might be talking on the phone and go, you're still there, you're still there. And you know that the communication is broken down because, you know, the phone line's been cut is what happened to Kim and I this morning and that sort of stuff. So I'm just hoping you're still with us.
Still here, Reese.
Good. All right, well, with timing, and that, sorry?
Oh, nothing. I just said I was still here.
Thank you, dear. And it's good to hear Nerissa's still out there, too. It's good to know family still sticks with us anyway. All right. And partners and stuff. All right. Now, imagine what it would be like if this course was all in just one big long sentence. You think that sentence I sent through the chat was hard enough to understand. Imagine if it was all this big one long thing. It wouldn't, and you notice I've broken this up into sections, like, you know, 3.2 is where we're up to now. And when Jackie and I wrote the lesson plan for this back 6 months ago, we broke it up into sections. We wanted to discuss one section after another. But imagine if we hadn't. We just chucked it all at you and went, blah, 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 blah. You wouldn't comprehend a single thought of it, and it would be very, very messy and horrible.
It would be very messy. I would agree with that.
Exactly. So Jackie and I wrote these lesson plans 6 months ago for a reason. A number of reasons, actually. One was we wanted to understand where we were in the program because we were sharing the responsibility back then. So I had to know, we had to assign each other roles. So I knew that Jackie would do this section and I would do another section, etc. It helped me keep track of it for timing reasons, so I knew that, you know, not too much of it was being delivered in too big a hit, or that, you know, we had to balance it off against the 2 hours that we allotted to do it. And we also had to be very cognizant of the way people like yourselves are going to receive the message. We have to be cognizant of the fact that we're not sending, you know, extraneous thoughts at you and going off the track. And that's why often, and I'm a bit of a stickler for this in my Toastmaster background, Jackie's teaching background, is that we do try and keep it on topic, because we don't want to get distracted by, I guess, other noise. So we format these into lesson plans. When we read sentences to people, we limit them in size to what people can receive at any one time. And as you're aware, an individual conversation may be made up of small sentences and other parts of the conversation. So, you know, we're not sort of throwing each other too much information in one hit. Likewise, when a long message is sent over the network, it is necessary to break it up into small pieces. The rules that govern the size of the messages and the size of the frames are very strict. They can also be different depending on the channel used. Frames that are too long or too short are not delivered. The size of frames, or the size restrictions of frames, require the source host to break the message into size, break down the message into sizable pieces that most that meet both the minimum and maximal size requirements. Each piece of this information is encapsulated into a separate frame and sent over the network. At the receiving host, these messages are received and put back together and then de-encapsulated and interpreted. Okay, well, I'm not going to go into the diagram. You can read that. Okay, let's have a look at what the scenario here. We have a computer one has an image that it wants to send to computer two on the network. Okay, computer one sends the message to computer two as a complete transmission in one block of information. Okay, it sends this stream of information to computer two, and computer two replies, "I cannot understand the data you sent me. It is not formatted. Oh, it is not formatted in correctly in the appropriate sizing blocks for me to understand." So the computer just spits it back and goes, "I don't get it." Okay, computer one takes in this message and resizes it into smaller blocks for computer two to understand. Okay, the smaller blocks are then reassembled on computer two, and the image can then once again be viewed as a single entity. Message timing is important. One other factor that governs as to whether a message is received is a factor called message timing. Now, people use timing to determine how fast to speak or how slow to talk, and how long to wait for a response. So, in Toastmasters, for example, and Marissa's seen me at a couple of Toastmaster meetings, we're often taught to use pause for effect. Or if some people, are particularly if they're new and they're getting nervous, might rush. And that way, sometimes when people are rushing, the message is a bit harder to understand. So we teach people how to speak slowly, or we often teach people how to use, vocal variety and the good old pause for effect. So the message is received and understood well. These are really pretty much rules of any engagement. Okay, any questions at this point?
All clear?
Okay, now the access method. Now the access method here is a bit like, again, chairing a Toastmasters meeting. When I was president, I would facilitate the meeting and hand control of that meeting over to the Toastmaster, who would act as a congenial host, who would then assign control over to the various presenters in the meeting. Once those presenters were finished speaking, they would hand back control to whoever they necessarily had to, which is usually invariably the Toastmaster, and at the end of the meeting, or when the business session occurred, the Toastmaster would hand the meeting back to the President, a la me. Now, same thing happens here. I am your facilitator today. Basically, I'm sending the message, as Jackie, if you listened back 6 months ago, was trying to be a little bit autocratic and say, "I am the God here and I am sending you this message. Listen up." And that's basically what I'm doing here. I'm saying, I've got control. I've got the floor. I'm speaking. That's why I stop every now and again and hand control over to you and ask you, are there any questions? Are there any questions? While I get another glass of orange juice.
None here.
None there? Okay, no problems. Okay, it's actually apple juice this week. And I'm filling it up, and that's it. It's dead. It's gone. So let's hope this glass will keep me going for another hour. So, this is the access method. Now, in some forums, you may be able to speak whenever you have something to say. That's fine. If you're at a party, just pipe up and talk. Even in this environment, the person has to wait until no one else is talking anyway, or else if they don't, you'll end up with a collision. If two people talk at the same time a collision occurs, it is necessary for the two people to back off and start again. Now, this is important in communications with computers, and we often refer to the term you'll hear as a collision domain, and that's coming up very shortly. So, you know, how many times have you, we've probably all done it here, you know, with a bit of latency with Ventrilo, somebody mics up, or particularly we can't see each other, so, well, two people mic up, and we all back off, and sheepishly we sort of start talking again in the hope that we're not going to collide with somebody else. Okay, an access method. We have an access method so computers know when to send a message, and computers know what to do when an error occurs. There's also flow control, which is referring to timing, and it refers to how much information can be sent at any one time, or on the speed it can be delivered. Now, if I spoke too quickly, for example, and kept on rabbiting on so very, very quickly, you'd hardly ever understand a word that I'd have said. If I just kept on saying that this is Discovery 1, Chapter 3, and we're going to learn about flow control, it would be very, very, very difficult to understand what I'm saying, and we'd never get anywhere anyway. But if, for example, I slowed down and we spoke about it more calmly, you'd get the message better. In communications, often a sending host can send messages faster than the receiving host can receive it. So, source and destination need to use a method of flow control to control the communications. Response timeout, which is another rule. How often do you, especially with modern day communications, do you say, hello, you're still there? I did it this morning with Kim. She rang me up and we're chatting away, and all of a sudden one of us is speaking, and I think I was in the middle of saying something, and I got no response. So, okay, a person has to assume that no answer is coming and act accordingly. In my instance, because of the nature of the phone call, I realised that she got a dropout. So we rang each other back. There are times, of course, where we might get distracted and the communication channel is still open, but the person might get distracted and I might say something to Kim, and if she's not listening, I might have to repeat the question. So that often happens too. Hosts on the network specify how long to wait for a response before it takes a particular action. Now, I'm rather fortunate that with my level of communications expertise, I can often tell whether the line's dropped out or whether there's any background noise, etc., etc. You know, so it's pretty quick for me to figure it out if there is a drop in communications. Okay, there's three different aspects of message timing that are used to control the data flow, described below. Access method, which I think we've already discussed, talks about the man and woman are communicating with each other. And the woman might ask, what time is the movie? The man might also just start to talk at the same time and ask, what time are we meeting for dinner? Because both are speaking or transmitting at the same time, the message received by each person or computer host is not clear, so the message has to be resent. Both the man and woman reply to their first attempt of communicating by saying to each, "I'm sorry, didn't understand you." Okay, back to flow control. The woman and the man are communicating over the telephone. The woman sends three quick messages. Hello, can you hear me? Hello, can you hear me? Hello, can you hear me? The man receives these messages and doesn't have an opportunity to respond. So he can't distinguish the beginning and the end of the message. He's unsure if the message has been received in its entirety or whether there is corruption in the stream of information. Hence the man's reply is as simple as, it's a symbol of a question mark. Well, it's interesting that I don't quite get what they're doing. But basically, the man will probably say, sorry, didn't understand you. Yes, I'm here. What's going on? Yeah, the man will be confused. Not uncommon. Okay. Response timeout. Man and woman again on the telephone. The woman queries the man, can you hear me? The man doesn't respond. Yes, he's probably got his eye on the sports pages or something. She repeats the question, but there's still no response from the man. The woman tries one last time to communicate with the man. She's resolved at this point to stop communicating with the man due to his lack of response. Yep, there you go. Breakdown in communications. Happens all the time in families. Right. Message patterns. Okay, this is where we start getting into communicating to a single person and multiple people at the same time. Okay, conversation between one person to another is a single one-to-one communications. When a group of recipients needs to receive a message at any one time, it is known as a one-to-many or a one-to-all message pattern is necessary. Like I'm speaking to you, I'm broadcasting to you, it's a one-to-all. There are times when a sender of a message needs to be sure that a message is delivered. Now, how often do I often say, are there any questions? Do I often say, are we being understood here? And I do like to hear the responses to know that you're still out there.
Still here?
I know. You're doing well, gang. You're doing well. Okay. Now, in the case of, say, certified or registered mail, it's necessary sometimes we just don't just stick it in a letter in the post and hope it gets there. We require a signature or an acknowledgement from the recipient that the parcel has been received. And you know, there's been numerous parcels I've received by going on the internet and doing online shopping and having them turned up and have been asked to sign for it so that the person sending it or the people sending it know that it got received and also that it got received by the right person. If no acknowledgement is required, sometimes the message pattern is referred to as unacknowledged. Okay, hosts on a network use similar message patterns to communicate. A one-to-one message is referred to as a unicast message, or as Jaws says, onicast. So we need to start getting familiar with a unicast message here. So in this instance, there's only one single destination for that message. If Kim and I were on Skype talking, as we often are, it's a unicast message. I'm talking to her and her only. When a host needs to send a message to one to many, it's known as a multicast message. And that's really what this is. It's a multicast message. A multicast message is a message sent from one host that is intended to be received by a group of hosts. In other words, my students, you guys. If all hosts on the network need to receive a message at the same time, it is referred to as a broadcast message. Now, you can actually think of Cavi as a big, huge network of people. We're only multicasting, I guess, to a certain part of Cavi, and that of the people who are enrolled in the Discovery course. I'm only talking to you people, or the people who happen to be listening to the recorded version of this. But there are messages that go out on the discussed list, and that's a broadcast to everybody. So, that, you know, Kerry might put up a message saying that his exploration course is now available for download. That's a broadcast message to all. Now, people who don't want to do exploration, they don't have to worry about it. They can worry about it if they want to, but they don't necessarily have to. But for the people in Kerry's course, for example, they do have to worry about it and can respond accordingly. And this is a one-to-all message pattern, a one-to-all broadcasting. What's another example of broadcasting? We hear it all the time. We even see it all the time.
Radio and TV.
That's it. Radio and television. Okay, there's a diagram there. I'll let you read in your notes. Human communications. Look, I think I just went over all that, basically talking about the way I do the lecture. Okay, now we'll look at it more.
These notes obviously get very repetitive.
Oh, they do, and because I know a lot of it, I often put my own interpretation on it. And then I read down the next paragraph and it's saying the same thing, and as you say, it is repetitive. Jackie and I took a lot of it out, and it doesn't seem to be any of the Jackie and I markup on this. So I don't even know whether we've actually, well, we must have done it because, I don't know, but usually Jackie and I mark them up in a particular way and I don't see any of those markings in it. And we take a lot of this junk out of it. All right, in computer communications, I know Paul and Marshall will have come across some of this. There are messages sent from a single destination to multiple hosts known as a broadcast or a multicast message. Oh, look, I've just outlined all that, basically. Basically, it goes into, well, the unicast message is a message sent from, say, computer 1 to computer 2 is a unicast message. A message sent from one computer to all of the computers, all of the hosts on a broadcast domain is a multicast message. And a broadcast sent from a broadcast source to all computers on the network is a broadcast message. And there are broadcast messages like ARP and stuff. We'll get to all that in a minute. Now, the protocols used in communications. We know that these are all governed by pre-established rules. These rules are governed by the type of the characteristics of the source and destination. This gets really repetitive, doesn't it? Okay, well, basically all these are message size, message formatting, and timing, and all that sort of stuff. I'm not going to repeat it. Okay, communicating on a local wide network, which is 3.3. Are there any questions at this point?
No, all clear.
Nothing from me.
All clear. All clear.
All clear, good. Okay, I'm going to skip the first two paragraphs of this because I just bloody said it. All right, okay, let's get into paragraph 3, which is... okay, as you know, that if everyone in the same room spoke a different language, we'd never be able to communicate. Likewise, if every device on a network used a different language, we'd never be able to communicate. The most common set of protocols used on wide networks is Ethernet. There you go, Pat, Ethernet. It's the most common group of protocols, and that's what it is. It won the war. We used to have the bad old days of Banyan Vines and Apple Talk, as I said before, and Novell NetWare, etc., etc. None of them talk to each other. Now they all do. They all talk Ethernet. Okay. The Ethernet protocol defines many aspects of communications, and they are message format, message size, timing, encoding, and message patterns. Okay, there's basically a diagram of three people in a room communicating. Basically, they're all talking Japanese, it says. And it basically refers to a diagram with four PCs connected to a switch. And they have to be talking the same language too, or they're not going to talk to each other. Okay, basically CC, the standardization of protocols. In the early days, each vendor used their own proprietary standards, as I've just mentioned, Novell, NetWare, and Apple, and all that sort of stuff. As networks became more widespread, standards were developed to allow network equipment from different vendors to communicate properly. These standards are beneficial in many ways. They facilitate design, simplify product development, promote competition, provide consistent interconnections, facilitate training, which is what we're doing, and provide more vendor choices for customers. So it doesn't matter now. As long as we like the product, we can buy it. We're not locked into buying Cisco. We're not locked into buying Netcom. We're not locked into buying an IBM computer, etc. They all speak the same language. There's no official networking standard, but over time Ethernet has become more common than the others and has really become the de facto standard. It won the war. How many people remember VHS and Betamax videos?
Yes, I do. Being an oldie.
Yep. We often see these standard wars. There's just been one between HD, DVD and Blu-ray. Blu-ray won it. So there's been many others, but there's just a couple to name a few. It says here there are other protocols. With protocols, there are some ones here that talk about IBM, NCR, Xerox, DEC, as in Digital Equipment, Hewlett Packard. Okay, and so dash on. Basically, during the 1980s, we started seeing some standards, such as the Ethernet IEEE 208-3, ArcNet 802.4 and Token Ring 802.5. These are the IEEE, or the International Electrical... Oh, God, what's IEEE stand for? I've had a mental blank. The IEEE. That's the Institute of Electronic and Electrical Engineers. Thank you very much. If I'd remembered Institute, that's it. There you go. So that's why we see these numbers, IEEE this, IEEE that. Okay, everybody, what's Wi-Fi?
802.11.
That's it, and there's been certain extensions to that, 802.11, A, B, C, A, B, G, and N, sorry. So you've got those different standards. And hang on, how much of that did I miss? Did I forget to press the button when I said the IEEE maintains these standards? Did that come through?
You did.
No, it didn't come through.
Oh, okay. I said that IEEE 802.3 circa 2000 won the race, and after that I went on to say how the IEEE maintains these standards of networking. The Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, pronounced IEEE, or IE, if you happen to be JAWS, maintains these networking standards, and also wireless standards. The IEEE committees are responsible for improving and maintaining the standards and the communications protocols. Each technology is assigned a number by the committee that refers to the committee that is responsible for improving and maintaining the standards. So basically what they're saying here is that these committees have a number, and that's where the number comes from, 802 something or other. 802.3 is the committee that's responsible for the Ethernet standards. So there you go, committee number 802.3. There you go, how about that? Since the creation of network standards in 1973, since the creation of Ethernet in 1973, that's how far back Ethernet goes, standards have evolved for specifying faster and more flexible versions of this technology. This ability for it to improve over time is one of the main reasons for it to be popular these days. Each version of Ethernet has an associated standard. Okay, for example, 802.3, and then it's got 100 base T, represents the 100 based, usually represents the 100 megabit to Ethernet cable. So basically 100 base, oh, with twisted pair cable, yes. So what they're saying here is basically 100 base T is 100 megabits per second using twisted pair cable. And that's why you often see 10 base T or 100 base T or gigabit Ethernet and that sort of stuff. Any comments at this point?
I was going to say...
Okay, we have a collision, everybody. Collision in our domain. Go ahead, Paul, you first.
Yeah, me. I was going to say that, you know, most technology these days is going to be 1000 base T, actually.
That's exactly right. So we often see that sometimes the course is not up to date. Well, a lot of people are still coming up on 100. I've got gigabit Ethernet here, but I only got it late last year. Go ahead, Marshall.
Yeah, I just wanted to make clear that what these standards are actually paper documentation or written documentation that describes, you know, the electrical and all the communications protocols. They're probably books, but I just wanted to define what they're talking about, because everybody throws the word standard around, but they don't ever mention that it's actually a written document.
They do mention this in... Oh, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead,
they
Paul.
They do mention this in the, if you ever go and take the Network Plus certification, they mention all this stuff. They have a whole chapter in several books on standards organizations. They have a chapter on it.
No, I bet you they do. There's plenty of people who want you to understand it. coming up here, there's a timeline. I'm not sure that I can read it all, but basically it starts off here at 1973. Ethernet was first developed by Dr. Robert Metcalfe at Xerox Corporation. Okay, 1980, Xerox Corporation and Digital Equipment released a standard for 10 megabit per second Ethernet. They did that over coaxial, actually, so that would be 10 base, the old 10 base 2 stuff. So that came out as early as 1980. 10 base, what have we got? 10 base 5 came out over 10 megabits per second over thick coaxial cable, came out in 1983. So it goes on, but basically I'd get you to read it in the notes. I don't know that you have to remember any of this in the test, but it's just always good to know the history of some of it, being a bit of an amateur historian as I am. Gigabit came out as early as 1996. There you go. How about that, Paul? 802.3Z. Then it came out in gigabit Ethernet came out on Twisted Pair in 1999. We had 10-bit, now it looks like we've got 10 gigabit Ethernet over fiber came out in 2002. In 2006 is the 802.3AN standard, which is 10 gigabit over twisted cable or something or other. So anyway, it's all there in the notes. Have a look at it if you feel like something to read at night when you go to sleep. Physical addressing. Okay, this is important. Any questions at this point? And I'm going to try and get through this next bit. Okay, so where we get into the nitty gritty here. Good. Okay, let's forget these standards. I probably shouldn't have bored you with the timeline. Okay, you've heard of IP addressing, gang, I assume. Yep, you must have. Everyone knows what the IP address is. But there's also another address known as the media access control or MAC address, physical addressing, which is a 48-bit number that is usually burned into the network card or the network adapter on your computer. Okay. And we were talking about the network adapter the other day, weren't we, Nerissa?
That's the same as the Ethernet adapter. Like the network...
Yep, network adapter, card. Ethernet adapter, yep, that's it. It's all synonymous. It's all the one gadget. Okay, well, we're going to use Ethernet across it, so yes, that's the Ethernet adapter, so network adapter. Okay. Okay, now as we already know, the source and destination of any communications, we need a name. I need to say, hi, Nerissa, how are you, etc. Okay, if we were all in a room together and I called out to Nerissa, everybody would hear that name, but only Nerissa would respond. Okay, is that making sense?
Yep.
On Ethernet networks, a similar method is used for identifying hosts, source and hosts. Okay, every network host has a physical address assigned to it when it's manufactured. This is usually burned into the card at manufacture time. Some of the cheaper cards, you can actually set them, but that's pretty dangerous doing that because you may actually set your hardware address to something that is actually the same as another hardware address and make horrible things happen to your network. So just take it as gratis that these things are usually burned into the card when they're manufactured. It's known as the media access control or MAC address. Okay, Ethernet networks are cable-based, meaning that there's either fiber optic or cable between the hosts. Are the networking devices, and this of course is referred to as the channel. Okay, when a host on a network wants to communicate, it sends frames containing its own MAC address, and the source and basically its own MAC address, which is the source, and the MAC address of the intended recipient. Any host that receives the frame will decode the frame and read the destination MAC address. If the MAC address matches the address configured on the NIC or burned into the NIC, the message will be received. And the message will then be transferred to the host's application to use. So in other words, if my workstation sends a message to my server and the MAC address turns out to be the MAC address of the server, the server will process that bit of information. If the MAC address doesn't match, what do you think would happen, gang?
Nothing.
Ignore it.
No, nothing received.
Yep, someone's read their notes. It ignores it, exactly. It goes, no, I'm not the right person, I'm ignoring it. Okay, there's a diagram here I'll flick through. I'll let you read that because it's all referring to hexadecimal numbers here, and it just will make it very, very impossible to read. But do refer to your notes, which I know a few of you are doing. Okay, basically the diagram just simply says this couple of hosts here, H4 and H2, are saying that the message isn't addressed to me. I'm just simply going to ignore it. H3, the message was intended for, and H3 pipes up and says, yep, this is mine, I'll accept the message. Okay, with the Ethernet protocols, it defines many standards, as in frame formatting, frame size, timing, and encoding. Okay, when these messages are sent, the hosts format the messages into the frame layout that is specified by the standards, and by these standards. Now, frames are often referred to as protocol data units, or PDUs. Okay, PDUs, protocol data units. Okay, the format specifies the, it is repetitive, source and destination MAC. Yeah, how many times do I need to say it? The MAC addresses. There are some additional pieces of information. There's a preamble for sequencing and timing. There's a what's known as a start of frame delimiter. There's information here which is the length and type of frame. And the frame check sequence to check transmission errors, the frame check sequence. And I think that's referred to in the test as FCS, frame check sequence. I saw it in the test earlier this morning. Okay, now this is important. I should have marked this up a bit there. The size of Ethernet frames are limited to a maximum size of 1,518 bytes, and a minimum size of 64 bytes. So the maximum size is 1,518 bytes, and a minimum size of 64 bytes. Now, frames that do not match these limits, and I have a feeling I saw this in a test somewhere once, frames that do not match these limits are not processed by the receiving hosts. Now, these bits are either transmitted as electrical impulses over copper wire, or they're a fiber optic over fiber optic cable. Okay, now I'm just seeing how much time we've got. Structure of the Ethernet frame. Now I'm just seeing how big this is. This is hard. Let's see if I can do it. You ready? Okay, there's a 7-bit preamble used to define timing, etc. And I'll get you to read the notes here. There's the starter frame delimiter, or SFD, that which is a byte that marks the end of the timing information and start of the frame. Okay, yep, there's the starter frame delimiter. That's what that does. Marks the start of the frame, basically. Okay, there's 6 bytes here for the destination MAC address. The destination MAC address can be a unicast, multicast, or broadcast. There's also 6 bytes here for the source MAC address, which is a sender. There's 2 bytes here for length type. Two bytes support 2 different uses, it says here. What else here? Oh, okay. Okay, there's the payload, 46 to 1500 bytes. So remember now, we remember how we said before there were 1516 bytes. Now, we've taken some of these bytes off here, so the payload or the data is 1500 bytes. And the encapsulated data, that is. So we've just stripped apart all that other junk, which is the length of, which is the, oh, where am I looking at? The length, the delimiter and all that sort of stuff there, the starter frame delimiter and all that sort of stuff. So after you strip all that off, you've got the payload to go. Okay. You've got the FCS, which is a check frame sequence, and I think I saw a question referring to that, which is 4 bytes. That's a device that sends a frame and a device that receives a frame to recalculate. And it's basically recalculated by the destination device to check for damage to the frame. So if the frame is damaged, it will be asked to send it again. Okay, any questions? This is a bit dry here, but it's important that we know this stuff.
Nope.
Okay, let's keep going. We'll see if we can end it where we ended it last 6 months ago. And look, guys, can I suggest, get down Jackie's and my version of this, even get down Kerry's version, particularly one from about 2 years ago. It was a bit funny. So, look, get down Jackie's and mine anyway, because they are... We emphasise different parts of this, and Kerry did a funny version of this about 2 years ago, so it's useful to listen to other lectures. Kim and I were going through one of Kerry's this morning, actually, having a bit of a giggle. It was good. Okay, imagine, now, we're talking about hierarchical addressing. This is where we're going to almost get to the breaking point. Hierarchical addressing, IP addressing, and telephone numbers and street addresses and stuff. And let's have a quick look at that before we end today's session, because this is where we'll pick up from next week. I'll actually go over this a bit again next week. Imagine how difficult communication would be if everybody had was only to use a certain person's name. Like, for example, there's probably billions of Narissas in the world, probably heaps of Kims, heaps of Marshalls, heaps of Pats. And if I just went, hey, Pat, well, okay, in this context, it's okay, because there's only one Pat. In this context, it's okay to say, hey, Kim, because there's only one Kim here. But imagine if there were two. We actually had two Garys in last class. One of them's with us again, and we used to have to say Gary G and Gary J, because it got confusing. Now, if there were no city, if there were no street addresses, towns, country boundaries to deliver a letter, it would get quite tricky if I wanted to send a letter to Kim in Ontario. Now, on an Ethernet network, a host MAC address is similar to a person's name. Okay, and MAC address identifies the identity of a specific host, but does not identify where that host is. This is important. A MAC address does not identifies a specific host, but doesn't really tell us where they are. Now, if all hosts on the internet, for example, over 400 million of them, were only identified by a MAC address, it would be it would create an awful amount of broadcast traffic to figure out where these people are. So it says here, additionally, Ethernet technology generates a lot of broadcast traffic, which it does, and that would be, the network would be just cluttered up with broadcast traffic, no useful information getting around it at all. Because as we will learn later, broadcasts are sent to all hosts within a single network, and that's for the people who are coming back to revisit us. Broadcast traffic is sent to all hosts on a particular network or network segment. So, we don't want our network segments getting too big, and that's when we discuss subnetting in more of the advanced lessons. Broadcasts can tune bandwidth and slow network performance. What would happen if the millions of hosts were connected on the internet by one Ethernet? Well, nothing very much would happen at all. It would all come to a grinding halt. For these reasons, large networks with many hosts connected are simply not efficient. It is better to divide large networks into smaller and more manageable pieces. One way to do this is to use a hierarchical design model. Okay, we have a diagram here that depicts an image of the world. It is primarily focusing on North America. The image then zooms into Canada, which indicates a particular country in North America. And we can see the specific boundaries to countries. As there are specific parameters and boundaries to networks. The next time the image zooms, it zooms in on Nova Scotia, which is actually a province of Canada. And the next zoom shows us the town of Halifax. And a specific location, which is usually, which in the diagram here, which is a house address on a certain street and a certain house number. So there you go. So we're able to sort of think about our networks in that way. And we do that when we talk about, oh, so-and-so's in Canada, so-and-so's in Australia, so-and-so's. And then we say, well, where in Australia? Oh, Melbourne, that's where Nerissa and I are. Where in Canada is Kim? Well, she's not in Nova Scotia, she's in Ontario. So it goes on. You know, one of the first things I asked Marshall when I met him is, where are you, Marshall? Oh, I'm in Utah. And then I think it worked out that you're in Salt Lake City, I think. And Paul just simply told us. So we can get a pretty good mental picture of where people are. Okay, we often talk, I'm going to skip that because it's not making any sense. Okay, now with our networking, we have smaller networks that consist of smaller groups of hosts that only mean that traffic remains local. Now this gets back to something Nerissa and we were all discussing before. In her local network, there's her computer's traffic. Only need to stay between her and Ian in that local network. It doesn't have to go out on the internet at all. And she could actually theoretically have the same IP, well, she can have the same IP addressing in her network as I do here, for example. They won't interfere with each other because they're on completely different network segments. Well, completely different networks, actually. The only time they can communicate is if they go around the packets and information is routed out through the internet by means of their router and my router. Now, this hierarchical layer design increases efficiency, increases optimization and functionality, and increased speed, of course. It also allows the network to scale as required because additional local networks can be added without impacting the performance of existing ones. For example, in a company you might have sales, marketing, management and production, for example, and if you wanted to add on a teaching arm, you could build another network and have that on a different subnet, for example, and not impact on the performance of the people who are doing, you know, the marketing and the management, etc. So you can add other additional local networks onto it. Okay. I think this is a good stopping point. We're actually up to three basic layers of our networking hierarchy, and that's the access layer, distribution layer, and core layer. And I'll go back over this next week, but it is a good point for us to stop. But they are terms you'll need to be familiar with if you are going to sit the exam this week or next week, access layer, core layer, and distribution layer. But I think it's been pretty steep. We're 10 minutes out from the end of the lesson, less than 10 minutes out from the end of the lesson. I'd rather hold that off till next week if we could. How to say this, everybody else?
Whatever suits you.
It's fine with me.
Whatever you do is fine with me, so that's okay.
Okay, what about Pat McKinn? How are you travelling? It's a bit dry and a bit involved, but we do need to be aware of these things, like where we've really concentrated on MAC addressing. We haven't really even thought about the IP address yet.
We don't really get into the IP addressing until Chapter 5, really.
Well, that's right. But there's other things about this chapter that goes on about a little bit of here about IP addressing. Oh, but actually, you're right, Paul. It goes on about the core layer, or the access layer and distribution layer and core layer of the network. And I found these terms a bit difficult to grapple with when I was new. But it does make sense, and you think, and there's another layered model called the RSI reference model, Open Systems Interconnect reference model, which I actually learnt before I learnt Discovery, and I started to learn that and equate to that, and in some ways I like it, and you'll probably find people like Kerry and Ian and all that like it better because it's another layered model. But I think in the context of Discovery, it's prudent to talk about the way they've got it set up here with the access layer. Distribution layer and core layer.
Distribution.
Yeah. So we'll talk about it all next week.
Once you get higher in the Cisco courses, they really focus on these three layers that you're talking about.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, they do actually. So we need to know. We don't want to go too much into it. What other things? We didn't really mark this up very well at all. Who marked it up? Yeah, we talk about logical addressing. Logical addressing is the IP addressing. So, you know, physical addressing is MAC address. Logical addressing is your IP address. And we might even find a telephone number scenario somewhere around the curriculum to draw your attention to. Access and we talk next week about access and distribution, access and distribution layer devices, which are the first two layers. What else are we talking about? Just give me a head here, just give you some idea. Building the access layer of an Ethernet. Okay, I might listen to what Jackie said about that last 6 months ago. So it's a pretty involved chapter, and this is why I say you do have the permission to get things wrong. Don't go doing the test until you're absolutely confident that you should be doing the test. I know a lot of people like to go, oh, wacko, the test is up, I can do it. I will put it up, but I really don't expect any of you to do it until we finish the chapter.
I made the mistake of taking 8 chapters all in one day.
No, that's pretty ambitious. Yeah, well, exactly. So I think if you concentrate on one at a time, that's why I was saying to people, folks, get that easy stuff out the way first, chapters 1 and 2. It's, you know, a lot of it's all junk, you know, and you might feel a few gaps in your knowledge here and there, and you go, beauty, okay. Because this stuff really changes tact here. It's hard. It's not easy. I know Narissa was talking to me on Sunday night, and she'd been grappling with it all, and it's, you know, it's okay to say you're not understanding it because it's all new concepts. Just because you've been playing around with computers for years, and I know all of you have, you've been having to assimilate a lot of new information here of stuff that you haven't really had to figure out before. So you do have permission to make a mistake.
I've got to run, Carrie, or Elise, so I'll see you. I may need to talk to you later tonight on Skype, so we'll see you later.
Yeah, have you got my Skype contact?
I do.
Excellent. Come up. We'll probably be around, and we can have a chat to you.
Oh, speaking of which, I may need to talk to you about a couple of things as well. So, do you know when you might be available?
Yeah, probably about an hour's time. If that's all right.
That's fine. Cause I think I might have to go somewhere. So, I think that'll be fine.
Do you want to come up in half an hour's time then?
Yeah.
All right, yeah, stay about half an hour out from the lecture, that would be good.
All right.
Okay, thanks right. for that, Paul. All right, well, I think we'll leave it at that this week. We also talk about the differences of MAC and IP addresses next week too, and I think that's important. And a lot of people don't get these concepts. This is why they often make mistakes, you know, and you see it all the time in the exams. You see people answering questions, and I find it very interesting, actually, to see where people are going wrong, so I'm going to try and make some of an effort based on the knowledge I got when I was looking at the stats from last year's version of this course, because I could see firsthand where some of you or some of the students at that time were having difficulty. So we'll try and see if we can't do anything about addressing
like
those.
Like myself, for example.
Yep, I might go through some of your exam results too. But I think, you know, this is what, the second or third time you've done it, Paul, so I think each subsequent visit you're probably getting more out of it.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, thank you. Well, we try and make it easy for people. We're here to do our best to see you succeed, and you know, sometimes we might be accused of oversimplifying it a bit, but you know, really we're here to ensure that we can give you the best opportunity that we can.
Well, thank you, Elise, and I really appreciate what you're doing with this program.
Thank you, Paul. That's very sweet of you. Thank you. All right. Well, are there any questions from Pat? You've gone a bit quiet there, Pat, Kim, and Narissa.
Well, I might come and talk to you on Skype later just to say hi. I've got no specific questions, and to say hi to you, Kim. So I'll catch up with you sometime later.
So that's fine. All right, gang. Thank you very, very much for your attention this week. It's been a privilege working with you again, and we'll see you all next week.
Thanks. Well, bye. Thank you.
Bye. And I'll see you later on Skype, Elise.
You will. Okay. See you later, folks.
See ya.
Bye-bye.